Good morning, everyone. My name is Faith Vigani, the Acting Chairperson for the Portfolio Committee on Mineral Resources. We are into our third day of public hearing, and hopefully the presenters for today are all here, and we are hoping to keep to strict time. I think the minds after the 3 days are quite tired, and hopefully we'll finish in time, can go and get a break, so that we can refresh for next week's start. The program. But before I start, can I just go to the house rules again, because I think they are working for us. Each presenter will be allowed a maximum of 15 minutes for an initial statement. Thereafter, 15 minutes will be allowed for members to comment on the presentation or to ask questions and for the responses of the presenter. Then when the second 15-minute period ends, we will move on to the next presenter on the agenda. If there are any questions that presenters are unable to answer in full, or additional points they wish to make, please put them in writing and send them to the committee secretary. And in this particular instance, the committee assistant, Bongile, at the back, or if she's still on the way, she must be still busy with logistics. And beyond that, we've got Martin, our committee researcher, who will also be collecting any presentations we have. You can discuss with him whether you send them by email. I think those presentations are very important to us, because in our deliberations they'll be useful for our way forward as a committee. And also because we get these black and white printouts at times, and when you come to drafts, you are unable to, and color-coded drafts in particular, you are unable to follow effectively. So it will help us when we do our own consolidation, that we are able to have a good understanding and deliberate properly on issues. So do give Martin those sticks to save or email him, whatever negotiation you have between yourselves and him. And then hopefully we'll be able to finish on time. And I think our first presentation, without further ado, is from Eskom. Eskom will introduce themselves after the members of Parliament have introduced themselves. Introduce yourselves and the rest of your team, and then we can start the proceedings. Thank you. Honourable
Kuno. Mr. Chair, my name is Ntabise Mkulo, a member of Parliament, acting for this committee. Thanks.
Yungwise Longele, a member of this committee.
Seiso Mohai, member. James Varma, member of the committee.
Henry Schmidt, member of the committee.
Thank you very much, and then for our support staff and of course for them, as we get along and get to know each other. Thank you. You may start.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, honourable members of the Portfolio Committee. I'll just introduce myself and the team. My name is Kanan Miharu. I'm the Acting Group Executive for Technology and Commercial, responsible for the what we call the primary energy space in Eskom. On my left-hand side, I have Kiran Maharaj. She's our Divisional Executive Primary Energy, responsible for all our coal procurement, as well as Ayanda Changa, also in the same team. And then on my right, I have a parliamentary liaison who is Karen De Villiers. So thank you firstly for the opportunity to present. Eskom has submitted some written comments on the bill, so we have sent that through. And this presentation will be relatively short, just trying to summarize some of our key suggestions and comments. Just to set the context, at Eskom, we have to secure nearly 2.1 billion tons of coal over the next 40 years that have not essentially been contracted. And that's based on our existing power stations that need coal. We've indicated on this slide that is in front of you where we think some of that will come. So over the next 5 years, we've got about 80% of our coal contracted. But as you see, as we go further, that percentage decreases. We have some idea of where we can get coal. One is from the Waterberg. We've identified some sources. We're busy negotiations to supply a Kusfield power station, and if we get that right, then we'll secure some of that coal. We are looking at our plus mines that currently supply some of our power stations, and looking at life extension, and that could plug some of the gaps. And then there's two areas where it's still uncertain, which is around, we've got some black emerging miners that we're busy engaging with and saying how much can we contract from them. And then the last one, which is uncertain, is our coal fields, they're not being opened up, and we need to figure out how do we get coal dedicated for power generation. This is not just for Eskom, this is generally for power generation. It could be IPPs and it could be ESCO. And so these are some of the suggestions or issues that we are concerned about. There are also some part of the context in terms of the security call for ESCOM. If you look over the last few years, our existing what we call tie collieries, that means tied to our power stations, have been underperforming due to various reasons. And we now had to top up the calls that we get from them from what we call medium source contracts, typically 10-year contracts, which are also more expensive and further away from our power stations. We've also had to run our power stations very hard for various reasons as well. One is new generation sources, including our own new build, plus other power stations are still coming in line. And therefore, when we run these power stations very hard, we actually, it's like, we're in a vicious circle, we actually need better quality coal, because otherwise our systems in the power stations cannot handle the waste product, the ash and so on. So actually, we need, as we start running them harder, we need better quality and consistency of coal. So that's the one challenge we face. As ESCO, we also observe that in the general coal market, we need substantial recapitalization investment to meet both our needs and other needs in the country, like Sasol as well, but also to meet the export requirements that are there. So clearly, the current mining capacity will not meet those demands, and that investment is needed. We've also seen that the mining costs, input mining costs, for us and for other sectors, have been higher than CPI and EPC. If you look at what Eskom's tariff determination has been in the last, for the next few years, for Eskom itself, it's 6%. We've also got a 2% IPP allocation. So 6% is the case. And already there we've made an assumption that prime energy costs will be between 8 and 10%, and that's a big risk. We've also seen that what the mining industry intends to do and what we need, the timing of our investments are not aligned. We've also seen that the trend of our market in South Africa is toward international export prices. There's the export parity pricing. And there's big pressure, especially from India, for the type of coal that Eskom would use. And you'll see later on we use the term RBCT3. That's Richards Bay Coal Terminal Category 3. That's the kind of coal quality that Eskom would typically burn. So there is now a market for that internationally. We've also seen, because of legislation around environmental compliance, and that's important, well, what that has done is that it has reduced the quantity of coal that's available for Eskom, because everyone has to reevaluate what they can mine, where they can mine, and that has reduced the availability of coal for Eskom. So that's the context, Jim. What is, there's five broad themes we'll repeat it a few times that have informed our submission to the bill. The first one, obviously, is the aim of the bill is to support economic growth, ensure energy security for South Africa, and ensure that these resources, these wonderful resources that we have, are developed properly. The second, in our view, is that we think that we have this local resource that has to be managed both for domestic energy use, in terms of coal, volume, time, and quality, but also that it does benefit the country when we export. So how to make sure there's the right balance between the two. So we feel also that coal should be declared a strategic mineral to allow this discussion to happen. And we should allow for also new technology investigation research. And there, for example, we talk about underground coal gasification. How do we support that? Because that could be a new area. And that's coal qualities we might not exploit if we had normal technology. And then the last one is that the bill should allow, we've got the state-owned mining corporation and we have other state-owned entities, and it should allow some level of partnership to ensure that coal or other mining assets that could be used for exploit for power generation. Thank you. I won't spend too much time on this. There's three areas of concern for us as Eskom. We've mentioned that. One is around possible coal supply shortages post-2018. And there are also other factors. I mean, it is great that Transnet Freight Rail is expanding their lines to Richards Bay, but it also puts pressure then on Eskom to secure the right volume and prices for its own coal, because there's now more opportunity to export. We also have unexploited coal fields in the Waterberg and Mpumalanga that need to be opened up if we're going to have long-term security. And as I've mentioned before, there is some pressure on the availability of coal because of other markets in Asia. And as I mentioned, the bill then should look at declaring coal as a strategic resource, how do we then exploit this in an orderly and economical manner that's sustainable. How do we have a structure that assists the minister in evaluation to allow the trading of the shares of companies that have prospective mining rights that allows them access to capital now? Because that's one of their struggles. What we're saying is that if we have new resources opened up, how does Eskom, and it could be not Eskom, it could be other entities, but how do you allow third right of refusal for energy use, local energy use? How do you ensure that the Department of Mineral Resources can enforce coal supply obligations with existing mining right holders? And how do we limit speculation on land where resources are needed for generation and domestic supply? There's been a discussion, and Eskom is not advocating price regulation. What we're asking for is we want to contract in commercial terms. We do. But we also want to make sure that the cost is based, or the price is based on cost plus fair return for local energy use. How do we get that right? That's the discussion we're having. And just what we put up there is some forecast for prices. And if you look at the bottom, there's a range between essentially 84 US dollars all the way to 193 US dollars on the far right. Now what that equates to is a rand per ton rate of from 500 to 1,000 rand a ton, which is more between 2 and 3 times our current cost. So that's where, if you just let it go to export prices, where rand per ton coal could go to. So that's our concern. It has a significant impact then on our pricing of electricity. So those are the trade-offs the country has to make. You know, if you don't have some level of the management of these prices of some way, there's a significant impact downstream on the electricity price and how to manage that. We also know that the electricity price is regulated. The coal price is not regulated. So how do you balance the volatility between the two? Who absorbs that volatility? So these are the challenges that we see. Then, just to get a little bit more technical, there are three specific areas that we think the committee should look at in terms of actual bill, where there might be some ambiguity, and maybe verification will help. The first is around timing of compliance period and expected timelines for approval. We feel they should be clearly stipulated, so that there's no, it gives more certainty to those who are applying for rights. So the first one is around compliance periods. I think the timelines have been removed in the favor of prescribed periods, and that would introduce inconsistencies. The second is also it'll help give clear timelines approval. It puts, it creates transparency and puts pressure on everyone to ensure things get done. So we suggest that that be put in place. Chair, the second, the next slide, we are concerned that there could be ambiguity about who is accountable for environmental health and safety. It's not really clear that if somebody sells on or passes on their rights, are they going to also pass on their obligation? So our view is that previous right holders must be explicit who is accountable for potential liabilities, environmental liabilities in this transition. Chair, also to be technical, we say that there should be no retention after the closure certificate is also issued, and that if you're creating some kind of rehabilitation fund, it should be aligned with the Income Tax Act. So those are more technical comments, and you'll find more detail in our written submissions. The last one, is around the award system. And this is about how do you deal with the order of processing. If you remember before, we used to have the concept of first in, first out, and it's not clear in the new amendment bill whether that's been removed or not. If it is, that's a big change. So that's the thing that needs to be understood. Also, it's not clear about what happens when you have an application that's in process and another one is pending. How do you process that? So our suggestion is that we should have some evaluation, the bill should have some evaluation criteria when we have two or more competing applications that have been received. We have some suggestions of what happens when you receive applications on the same date, so you just deal with it in the order of receipt. It needs to be made clear how the minister will determine or decide who gets the rights, so there's also transparency there. And then lastly, a structure to be established will help the minister in evaluations. And then we suggestion that in the previous bill provision section 9 in terms of the order processing, that could be restated. Chair, so those are more technical comments. We have put more detailed comments in our written submission. We won't go through that. That is available for the committee. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Engagement? Honourable Lorimer?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just to start with, I'm not sure that I understand on page 4, your third bullet point there. You say coal must be declared a strategic mineral that is required to firstly support domestic energy security and secondly to ensure South Africa can maximise its export potential. How is limiting exports going to maximise our export potential?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On slide number 7, I share your concern concerning or relating to your relations, because what the bill seems to do is seem to be a enormous form of rule by ministerial decree, because the substantive parts of the bill will be concerning the regulations. But what we have now is was made available on the 11th of September, Wednesday morning, is a copy of the draft mineral regulations as to timelines. But timelines are not important issues. It's a substantial part of the bill that needs addressing. And the timeline basically about which period a application has to be accepted or rejected, and there is kind of procedural issues. The other concern I have, and so my concern is shared in terms of the substantial nature of the bill, which puts Eskom in a very precarious position, being a price taker, if I understand correctly, in terms of coal supply. But it struck me this morning, Tassel also presented it yesterday, and the concerns don't seem to correlate with yours, because they're also an energy producer. They have some control over their supply because they have a coal mining division, let's call it that. So they can control, but what is it that differentiates Sasol, to my mind, with Eskom? Because Sasol has not come to the committee saying, listen, I've got a problem with my supply. In fact, it has regulated its affairs to such an extent that the supply of coal and impact on the price is not an issue. You follow what I'm saying? Is it because Sasol is a private sector company which looks after its affairs in the most proficient way? And Eskom is a price taker, which is now said, well, because of the market changes, I've not kept and adjusted my method of operation, therefore I'm left to the mercy of the market, but has never partaken in the market or never understood the market, either deliberately or unintentionally. It's a perception which I would like you to address, because it is a serious perception, because it is the role between something like Sasol, which produces energy, Eskom that produces energy in a different format, using the same base, resource base. And the concerns seem to be totally different. Thank you.
Honourable Kuno.
Thank you, Chairperson. Your slide 9 says a culture needs to be established towards the minister in evaluation. But if you look into the bill, there's a composition of the Regional Mining Development and Environmental Commission. Don't you think it's taken care of in the bill? What is it that, what you have written there that the minister needs to establish people that will help you here with evaluation? Is that committee not enough for you?
Honorable Mohai.
Well, thanks, Chair. Just a comment on from presentation. I think the premise for me is that Eskom is one of the oldest state public entity or state corporation historically, as we have just evolved, and it amassed a lot of expertise, and the reason for the creation of Eskom, among others, I think was on the basis of investment, or jointly working with the state in investing in the industrial development of the country. So I believe it's still an obligation for Eskom for industrial development, which is the path that our economy is taking for growth and its development. Now, with Eskom's change and relations with the state, and creation is of course of the state. I just want to get it clear, its admission with regard to how we address the shortages of coal, which you say is a major concern. Obviously the state is of same interest, that protection of coal to address its future investment is critical to the development of the country. I just want to know very clear. Because other issues, I assume that you agree with the spirit of the review of the legislation. It's my assumption that you agree with the spirit of the review of the legislation. But there are certain areas which need to be tightened in moving forward. Thanks.
Would you care to respond to that first?
Thank you, and I'll ask Commissioner to you. I think what you'll find is that when you look at the coal opening a coal mine, the Eskom offtake is very important to really maximize the potential of a mine, because you get the better quality for export, and between what they call the middling product and some of the fines, there's ability to wash the product and give it to Eskom. So by providing certainty in one as well, you help maximize the ability to export as well. That's what we're not saying that it's all or nothing. It's about saying the support of the offtake from Eskom helps you also to export. And trying to get the right balance is important. And many mines need that. Many mines are not, economically viable without an Eskom offtake as well. And it's a benefit somehow, but just then helps them with their profitability if Eskom is the offtaker. So I think that's the balance that we're talking about. In terms of the second question around Sasol, I think the advantage Sasol has is it has its one coal mine. It controls its feed. Eskom does not. It used to in the past. It has its own mining rights as Eskom. And therefore we had some ability to control that. We do not, as Eskom, have that anymore. So we do depend on a very strong collaboration with the coal mining industry and the state in ensuring that there's enough coal for domestic production. We do have, as Eskom, an understanding of mines, and we have been efficient in the way we manage it. If you look at our management of the current coal contracts, it's very good. We have managed to keep those prices down. What we have struggled with is where we sign medium and long and short-term contracts, because that is more linked to the export parity pricing. And we would not be the only ones who put in that position. If we obviously had the ability to pass that on, then that's a different case. We also think that it is important for South Africa to have a very stable electricity price going forward. And we've learned some lessons as a country about that volatility. So how do we get that right? And that's what we're talking about. It has to be something we do together with the state, with the coal mine industry and Eskom. We're not saying that it should just meet our interests, it should meet everyone's interests. So that's the discussion we're having. I remember, in terms of the question around the committee, we'll check that again. I understand when you first read it, it wasn't clear that that would be the committee for valuation, but I'll double check that and we'll come back if we feel that if that meets the requirements. I think on our first pass, maybe we assumed it wouldn't be the one that helps the minister. So we'll check that and come back. Remember. In terms of your last question around do we agree with the spirit, I think generally we do. All we're asking is how do we tighten it? So your point is exactly right. How do we tighten it? Maybe there are a few things that are ambiguous. How do we make sure we close those loops? So I think those are the comments. Kira, did I say anything? Thank you.
So now, as I understand it, you're saying that mines need an Eskom contract to help them be viable. So why do you need to limit their efforts? Why can't you just offer them a contract? Before you answer that, I'm going to go on. I'm still struggling with the big picture here. So you're saying that there's not enough coal for your needs because too much is being exported. So you want to limit some of those exports so that more of that coal can go to you. So you're going to force miners to sell some of their coal to you. Now, if you look at the way the coal works, there's a minority of coal production that is exported, but that is responsible for the majority of earnings in mines. So effectively what you're going to do is going to affect the productivity of coal mines quite seriously. Quite how seriously depends on how much you limit their exports. So that is going to make coal mining less profitable. So if you're making coal mining less profitable, is there going to be more coal mining or less coal mining? More supply of coal or less supply of coal?
Thank you, Chairperson. With the little engagement that I've had, it's actually a bit expensive to export coal. And you have a problem. You need more suppliers, so the demand is high locally as well. How do we have any mechanisms, any plans as Eskom to make your prices more competitive, to make sure that you, because I think as a company, you need to have a strategy of making people not to export because there's demand locally. Do you have any plans, any mechanisms to do that? Because we need to help each other. I mean, this is a public entity. But I think helping each other, as you want to make your company profitable, you need to have plans and tell us, you know, if this is done this way, it's going to help us as Eskom. Thanks, Chair. I'm not sure that. I hope I'm safe. Another question?
Thank you, Chair. I think what's been said now, especially by Mr. Lorimer, precedes what my biggest concern with your presentation is the sentence that says that the South African coal sector requires substantial investment and recapitalization to meet both domestic and export requirements, as the current mining capacity will not meet the growing demand. So, seemingly, you're saying that there's a shortage of investment in the coal, South African coal mining environment. Now, I think it follows with what Mr. Lorimer said, because it is already, as of before having coal declared a designated mineral, you're saying that requirement will be met, indirectly you're saying it will be met by the fact that we're going to declare the designated mineral, control the price, control the question as to whether a coal mining company may export its mineral, thereby expecting higher investment in the coal sector. Now, you know, I'm not the biggest economist around here, but I do have economics 101. That doesn't seem to me the way to go about to get coal mining investment in this country to ensure that there's a sufficient supply of coal to Eskom at a particular price. It seems to go about exactly the incorrect way. Now, I've qualified my question by saying I'm not the biggest economist, so please just address me as to how that issue in your mind is we're going to go about it.
Thank you. I want to start with your question, Madam Member, around our strategy. At Eskom, we do have we have a strategy around our emerging miners. We have five pillars that I won't go through that in detail. We have presented it publicly before around how do we support especially emerging miners and try to get a balance in the investment as well as and export availability. Because we have some way of supporting that. So that's something we're engaging with. We've engaged with the big four mining houses as well on those issues. So I'll go into that detail. That could be another time, but we do have a strategy that we have shared and engaged with the big four mining houses as well on. And that's an ongoing discussion between all of us about how to support that. What I'd like to do, just in the interest of time, is Kieran, if she can answer some of the questions that the two members raised. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning. I would just want to add to the back end of what Karen was saying. I think it's true that if you want to keep electricity prices low, you can't actually be competitive from a coal pricing point of view with the export industry. However, we are not saying that the prices that we offer are not sufficient to cover return. So the pricing principle that we use is cost but a fair return. The return is fairly competitive from a market point of view, but maybe not as competitive as that which you would earn in the export industry, and perhaps for diversified mining companies as well, to earn, you know, the comparative minerals. But it's cost, it comes from the mining industry, not to say return that does keep them profitable, you know, at a suitable level, and it comes about in commercial negotiations to agreement. So I wouldn't say we are able to compete with the export industry, but I would say that we are able to offer competitive economic prices that cover cost and provide a fair return. Also, I just want to point out that if you look at the current mining industry, it is built off the back of those kind of arrangements and the stability of an offtake and a cash flow that comes out of Acom. So it also has other options being associated with a big government entity that is backed up by the fact that we can, you know, can pay for what we buy for.
Can I ask you, that means if you look at Exxaro, if you look at Anglo Coal, Bexa, and even Glencoe Extrato, all of them, if you look at their leases, all of Eskom cost plus contracts. That is the point.
Okay. So let me just comment on the debate about the limitation of exports, and I must also say I'm not an economist either. But I think, you know, what we're saying is, so if you look at why is it you would ask to secure coal as a domestic resource, it's really about making sure that we keep the lights on, so that we have a stable coal supply at the qualities and the volumes that are required, so we can run this coal deal that the country is interested in. Now, it's not unknown. If you look at several international countries, I mean, specifically Indonesia, who's just done this recently and turned very much the tables about coal supply balance in the country, that is basically what we're asking for. So one may argue that, yes, you are not able to get out a full export market, and the question would really be, and I must be honest, I don't have any better answer, the question would really be, how much of export are you sacrificing for domestic security? But it's also important to us at this point in time that with the geological qualities of the reserve declining, because we've mined out all the better spots thus far, is that if you have to mine at an export space, the product that is left for Eskom is actually very unsuitable for what we need. And the challenge is we built this plant a long time ago. Even if we don't run it as hard as we currently do, we need coal of a specific quality. And if you mine at an export spec, you are not going to be able to meet the quality. So you're going to have to beneficiate that coal in some way, and then you start to carry the cost of the beneficiation in the domestic coal price and not the export coal price. So essentially, I think there is a medium for the balance. While it might not be completely maximizing the export potential out of country, it is the balance that needs to be struck between securing coal for domestic electricity requirements versus coal for export industry. Some of the things that we've looked at shows that there will be growth in the export industry, if not anything else maintained at the current levels, which in any event will require investment of new mines, even if you didn't secure the domestic supply. So you will have the export industry in the current, basically the current form that it has, but then you would also be able to create the domestic energy supply required to underpin electricity. It also comes back to the point of, at the current export prices and the export prices we've been seeing, the revenue potential out of the export industry is very significant. But we've also seen times when the coal price has dropped significantly, and Eskom then becomes a very competitive option because we still fail to offer a fair return to the mining industry, and that coexistence has been beneficial to all of us thus far.
I'm a layperson in this instance. But is there no system in place that controls what you're talking about for us to try and get a balance or to take care of our needs first in terms of coal? Because I know for a fact that there's a high demand from outside, and for some reason or the other, they feel that we've got better coal. While you're saying that you require a coal of a particular standard, is there no way of sifting that out such that before the export is done, you get whatever coal you need to get? Because to me it will give me a picture that perhaps you'd also start having qualms about the cost of electricity at the end of it.
Chair, the short answer is no. Everything at the moment is based on commercial competitive arrangements.
Thank you for the explanation. Your Indonesian example kind of puts it in, and I will go look it up. But isn't this a typical example, I'm asking, of the efficiency of a public organization compared to institutions such as CESA? The inefficiencies which is created by this can be the focus on production and the focus on a private company is totally different from a public company. What you see now is intervention in the market is to ensure a feed supply, which is not even at stake, not even an issue, as I said. Isn't any answer to the issue and start unbundling Eskom to get into the private sector PPP scenario?
Sure, in fact, the opposite. If we're like India, which is fully privatized, if you will, in many sectors, but also state-owned, and where there's a mercy, if you want, of the coal producers and so on, we'd be in the same situation. You'd have the blackouts you've seen in India. It's opposite. If we would any other private sector company would not necessarily do what we're doing and protect, focus on the way we're doing things around ensuring we balance security of supply, ensure we try to minimize the price, cost off, and so on. That's what we've had to do. We definitely have areas of improvement in terms of efficiency. There's no doubt about that. But I think also Eskom has done a great job in trying to minimize the cost possible and doing that by sacrificing some of its own returns, as well as trying to ensure the viability of the coal mining industry. So I think it's awesome. And you can just go research India as a counter example.
You know, I'm tempted to go on, but your time is up. There's a lot more I have, I suppose, I don't know. But thank you. There's definitely a lot of Eskom we are going to chew it, but unfortunately, if I'm out of order, then the whole thing will be out of order. Let's have a talk later if you have time. Okay, thanks. We're now going to have Urban Venter. Ready?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Peter Leon of Weber Wenzel. I'm here with my colleague, Jonathan Beeren, and I will make a hopefully succinct presentation on our written submission on the NPRDA amendment bill, which, as you know, is some 65 pages, so I shall try and be as succinct as possible in summarising what we have said. Can I start off by saying that we certainly agree with the bill's objectives, which is to create a better mineral regulatory system by streamlining the administrative process and introducing a regulatory reform and removing ambiguities from the NPRDA itself. The problem is that the bill not only doesn't meet these objectives, but actually exacerbates existing problems with the NPRDA itself. And why do we say that? One of the key reasons is that the bill, and this has been touched on in some of the other submissions, is very much a case of rule by regulation rather than rule by law. And that is a very concerning issue for the mining industry, bearing in mind where South Africa stands now in terms of the Fraser Institute survey that comes out every year, which was produced this March, and showed that South Africa is now at position number 64 of 96 countries surveyed by the Fraser Institute. Now compare that with Botswana, which is a significant diamond producer, which is at position 17, the highest position in Africa. So South Africa is in the bottom third of the class because of its mineral regulatory system. Botswana is in the top 20. That's just by way of introduction. Just to build on that, the first concern we have with the bill, Madam Chair, is the issue of unguided administrative discretion. I know that's come up in some of the submissions that happened that have occurred already. Why do we say this? And that is, we're trying to give regulators discretion, and all statutes do that. The problem with this bill is that the discretion which is given to regulators, whether it's the minister or regional managers, is unguided. And that occurs in a number of provisions. It occurs in relation to beneficiation under Clause 8. It occurs in Clause 21, which gives the minister broad discretion on the conditions for the transfer, prospecting, and mining rights. Then, as touched on in the Eskom presentation, the bill eliminates all time periods previously provided for in the NPRDA, and this is now left to ministerial discretion. Now, there's a problem with this, and there's a constitutional problem with this, because the Constitution of South Africa, which obviously binds all of us, has in Section 1C a foundational provision around the rule of law, which is a key provision of our Constitution. Basically, the Constitutional Court has interpreted this to say that laws have to be reasonably certain and administered in a predictable manner. So if you don't have certainty and predictability in legislation, you're entering the terrain of unconstitutionality. And there are a whole lot of cases on that which we've given our submission. I just want to build on that. One of the key cases around this issue was in the whole lot of litigation with the Minister of Home Affairs in the first 5 years of democracy. The Constitutional Court said in the Darwood case, if broad discretionary powers contain no express constraints, those who are affected by the exercise of the broad discretionary powers will not know what is relevant to the exercise of their powers or in what circumstances they are entitled to seek relief from an adverse decision. And then in a more recent case, in Affordable Medicines Trust and the Minister of Health, the Constitutional Court said in 2005, the law must indicate with reasonable certainty to those who are bound by it what is required of them so that they may regulate their conduct accordingly. So I think it's pretty clear that the rule of law is foundational to our constitutional democracy. And indeed, Madam Chair, that was recognized by no less a person than the Deputy President of the Republic, Honourable Khalema Maplanty, who has driven the framework agreement for a sustainable mining industry to sign as recently as the 3rd of July this year, in which it was said that the rule of law and the government of the Republic signed up to this with organized labor and business, that the rule of law and stability is a fundamental pillar of our democracy and the necessity to ensure economic and social development. Now, we understand, and I think mention was made this morning, of the fact that regulations are going to be published in terms of the bill, which would limit the minister's discretion. But there are two issues with that. The first is regulations are not law, and they can be changed overnight. They don't involve a public participation process, which you've seen now in Parliament. And thirdly, the Constitutional Court again has warned in the Western Cape case back in 1995 that an excessive delegation of power to the administration, to the executive, can be unconstitutional, which can potentially violate the separation of powers. So, Madam Chair, I go on to deal now with the issue of restriction on exports, which obviously came up in the Eskom presentation. I can go into that in a little bit more detail. The Clause 21 of the bill obliges the Minister to initiate the beneficiation of exports, mineral products and petroleum in South Africa. Under this clause, the Minister has broad discretionary power to set the levels required for beneficiation, the percentage per commodity required to be beneficiated, the developmental pricing conditions for beneficiation, and the percentage of raw mineral products to be offered to local beneficiators. Now, the immediate problem with this, besides any of the economic issues, is that absolutely no criteria are prescribed in the bill as to how these extensive powers are going to be exercised. So the first issue here is a potential violation of Section 1C of the Constitution, which is a rule of law provision. The next thing is that the Clause 21D, first of all, it's not clear whether this is going to apply prospectively or retrospectively. If it applies retrospectively, it will obviously have a very severe impact on mining companies' contracts with their customers for exports. And that will have a whole lot of implications in itself. But then it goes on to say that under Clause 21D of the bill, Section 26(3) of the Act is to be amended, that any poor person who wants to export designated minerals has to obtain the Minister's written consent. Now, when you look at the definition of designated minerals, it says such minerals as the Minister may designate for beneficiation purposes as and when the need arises in the Gazette. And that basically tells you, in our view, absolutely nothing at all. The other problem is that the term economically has now been deleted from 26(2) of the Act, so it no longer requires the Minister to make such determination whether or not this is economically feasible. So that is an issue in itself. Now, there are obviously, besides the rule of law issue, there are a number of legal problems, other legal problems with this, which we would urge the committee to consider. The first is, and I think it's the most problematic, is that effectively the bill introduces an export licensing system. Now, the problem about that, Madam Chair, is that export licensing systems are unlawful as a matter of international law. South Africa has signed the Marrakesh Agreement, which established the World Trade Organization in 1995. And South Africa has also entered into a trade development and cooperation agreement with the European Union, which took effect, signed in 1999, and took effect in 2000. Under both of those agreements, one cannot impose quantitative restrictions on exports or imports. They are simply prohibited. And in fact, under the EU agreement, the provisions are even more stringent, and I'll show you that in a moment. Obviously, that can have international law consequences, but I just want to mention, if I can, just quote, if I can, Article 11 of the GATT agreement, which is the WTO agreement. It says, no prohibitions or restrictions other than duties, taxes, or charges, whether made effective through quotas, import or export licenses, or other measures, shall be instituted and maintained by any contracting party on the importation of any product, the territory of another contracting party, or on the exportation or sale for export of any product destined for the territory of any other contracting party. That's Article 11(1) of the WTO agreement. And if you look at the European Union agreement, the TDCA, Trade Development Cooperation Agreement of 1999, took effect in 2000, it says quantitative restrictions on imports or exports and measures having an equivalent effect on trade between South Africa and the European Community shall be abolished on the entry into force of this agreement. Then it says in Article 2, no new quantitative restrictions on imports or exports, measures having a equivalent effect, shall be introduced in trade between the European Community and South Africa. I don't think it could be clearer, Madam Chair, that there is a serious international law problem with both these proposals, which will have consequences for South Africa if this bill is enacted. The other thing is that a number of mining companies incorporated in the European Union and elsewhere have protection under bilateral investment agreements with South Africa, bilateral investment treaties with South Africa. Currently, there are 23 bilateral investment treaties in force. I know that the South African government has terminated the agreement with the Luxembourg and Belgium and the one in Spain, but most of the mining companies are listed in London and are protected by the UK South Africa Bilateral Investment Treaty, or in Switzerland, the Swiss Treaty is still in force. And that says, under these treaties, investors have to be afforded fair and equitable treatment. And basically that means that South Africa is obliged as a matter of international law to maintain a predictable regulatory environment for protection of investments in South Africa. So if the rules of the game start changing suddenly, we've invested 20 years ago, and the rules change unpredictably, the mine company in question potentially have a bilateral investment treaty claim against South Africa. So that's in terms of a fair and equitable treatment provision. But there's a final point I want to make around this issue of restrictions on exports, and that is this is an issue that potentially engages the Constitution again, because Section 231(2) of the Constitution says that an international agreement binds the Republic after it's been approved by resolution in Parliament. And both the WTO agreement and the European Union Free Trade Agreement were subject to resolution by Parliament. In the Glenister case, where this issue came up in a completely different context, the context of the UN Convention Against Corruption and the Anti-Bribery Convention, the Court of Constitutional Court said that the main force of Section 231 is in the international sphere. An international agreement approved by Parliament becomes binding on the Republic. But that does not mean that it has no domestic constitutional effect. The Constitution itself provides that an agreement so approved binds the Republic. And so that obviously then has rule of law implications, and effectively what this means is that the legislature, that is you, this committee, Madam Chair, has to take into account South Africa's international law obligations when it enacts legislation. So those are the points I'd like to make on the export restrictions in matter of international law. On the issue of constitutionality, I think the other issue that comes up in relation to Clause 21, which is the development of pricing conditions and beneficiation provisions around minerals, is the fact that this could potentially be an arbitrary deprivation of property. And I just want to draw the committee's attention to section 25.1 of the Constitution, which says that no one may be deprived of property except in terms of law general application, and no law may permit arbitrary deprivation of property. And the Constitutional Court has held that any interference with the use, enjoyment, or exploitation of private property involves some deprivation in respect to the person having title or right to or in the property concerned. So a deprivation of property is unconstitutional where it is arbitrary or procedurally unfair. And that can happen when there are no clear rules for the deprivation and there are no criteria given for the deprivation. In those circumstances, the deprivation will be arbitrary. And certainly our contention, Madam Chair, that these provisions are potentially arbitrary, and therefore if they are, they would contravene section 25.1 of the Constitution. Because there are no constraints on the Minister's discretion here. There are no clear rules of procedure. And so there are real issues around constitutionality. Then I'd like to go on to a different subject briefly, Mr. Chair. And then we've touched on the Hessian submission. Section 7 of the MPRDA appears to be deleted, and that means that the first-in-first assess principle, which has been part of South African mining law for over 100 years, has suddenly gone out the window. And what we have in its place is a provision where the Minister has the right to periodically invite applications for rights by way of notice in the Government Gazette, prescribe the period within which applications must be lodged, and set the terms and conditions subject to which the rights may be granted. Now, the problem about this, Madam Chair, is that it confuses two principles. The one, as I say, I think the first-to-first assessed principle has been jettisoned, not clear. But what you have in mining law is either a first-to-first assessed principle, which is generally the case in most mining jurisdictions, or you have a competitive tender system. Now, some countries have introduced that, like Kazakhstan, Liberia, and Africa, and Mongolia, where the rights are auctioned by the state. And there are certainly merits in that, because obviously there could be a huge capital windfall for the government. But what this does, it's not clear what does it do. You neither seem to have an auction system nor a feeder system. It seems to be a sort of strange mixture of both. And I really would urge the committee to look at that again. Then Clause 12 bill is concentration of rights. And now Section 17 of the Act is being amended by Clause 12, which now says the Minister has the ability to refuse or grant any additional prospecting or mining right to an applicant where this would lead to the concentration of rights in question under the control of the applicant and its associated companies. So this goes beyond what is in the Act at the moment, where this power only exists in relation to prospecting rights and retention permits. And it also uses the term concentration of rights rather than concentration of mineral resources. It seems to be aimed at the major mining companies. I don't know, that would appear to be the case. But, I mean, the issue here, Madam Chair, is a more fundamental one. And basically, it seems to us that here the Department of Mineral Resources set itself up as a competition regulator. This is exactly the sort of issue that should be regulated by the Competition Commission and the Competition Act, rather than the Department of Mineral Resources, which is a minerals regulator, which should apply minerals law, mining law, mineral regulation, not competition law, to mining issues. And certainly we think that the Competition Commission would be the right authority to be looking at these issues. And if I go on briefly to deal with penalties under Clause 70, now these, I know this has been touched on a number of submissions, these are suddenly increased substantially. They now are based again on the Competition Act. There will now, under Clause 99, be penalties with a reference to a percentage of annual turnover in South Africa and exports from South Africa in the preceding year. It seems to us that these provisions have been based on Section 59 again of the Competition Act, which in turn has been influenced by EU competition law. But I just want to draw this committee's attention to the recent decision of Competition Appeal Court in the Southern Pipeline Contractors case, where the court said a penalty should be proportional to severity, degree of blameworthiness of the offending party, the nature of the events, and the effect on the South African economy in general and consumers in particular, and that the administrative penalty should not only promote the important objective of terrorism, but the site should not be lost to the fairness of the offending party. Just seems to us, Madam Chair, that there doesn't seem to be any rational basis for imposing this turnover penalty on mining companies for what might be a very minor breach of the MPRDA. So I think we would certainly suggest that is looked at again. And then just finally, if I may, just to deal briefly with tailings, I know this will probably come up in some of the other submissions, but the under the Act at the moment, only tailings which are produced in terms of that have occurred as a result of a production under the existing MPRDA are regulated by the MPRDA. And the High Court of the Free State in the Beers case made it clear that tailings that were produced by a mining company, an old mining company or a done mining company before the MPRDA took effect were not subject to the MPRDA. This bill basically amends or reverses the Beers decision legislatively, and effectively tailings will now be subject to the MPRDA whether or not they existed before the MPRDA came into effect. Simply the caution I would place here is that would raise again constitutional issues around expropriation. They may also raise issues under the relevant bilateral investment treaties if the mining company is protected by a bilateral investment treaty. Madam Chair, just in conclusion, I'd like to just make one or two observations. One is that the National Development Plan, which was adopted by Cabinet in September 2012, noted and observed that over the past decade, domestic mining has failed to match the global growth trend in mineral exports due to poor infrastructure alongside regulatory and policy frameworks that hinder investment. Seems to me that the bill does not take account of what the National Development Plan has so pertinently pointed out. And certainly, we would say that the bill, as it stands at the moment, would simply exacerbate the problems that exist currently in relation to the MPRDA. We would go further than that, Madam Chair, and suggest that this committee conducts a full regulatory impact assessment on the effect of this bill on the South African mining industry. And that, you know, I just point out that, you know, if one looks at what happened in the wake of the strikes and the labour unrest in after Marikana, 12 billion rand was lost in exports, 15 billion rand in lost mine production. South Africa's GDP declined by 0.5% last year post Marikana. I'm not saying this is another Marikana, heaven forbid, but I mean one needs to be aware of what the consequences are of legislation before it is enacted. And then just finally, Madam Chair, on the international law side, I thought it might be useful to quote the US-Iran Claims Tribunal decision, Starrett Housing Corporation versus Iran, in 1983, just as something that the committee should take note of. The measures taken by a state can interfere with property rights to such an extent that these rights are rendered so useless that they must be deemed to have been expropriated, even though the state did not purport to have expropriated them, and the legal title of property formally remains with the original owner. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks to the presenter. You know, we are influenced by different ways of thinking. You know, as a past representative, especially from the ANC, what influences us is excellent on the community and the people's shame that is influencing us. I know, I mean, throughout your presentation, you've been influenced by international treaties that different countries sign. And they change. We are members of parliament. These things change from one year to the other. So it may suit you now, but I agree with you if it has been said in parliament, we have to go according to that way. But keeping in mind that we have to share in the country's wealth. You are really rewriting the whole bill. with all your suggestions. And I think that we will have time to look into all the all presentations from different companies when dealing with the bill clause by clause. But there are so many things that you have contradicted yourself. I mean, most of the what you said, Section 21D, to me, the thinking that people have to share in the council, you're actually saying that the minister should not have power. This is how I've understood you to be saying. Because somebody has to regulate. Somebody has to be in charge of doing things. Things cannot go on as normal. If mining industry for the past 100 years has survived through this way, and it did not actually help the public, we need to change other things to make sure that we share in the country's wealth. What we have minerals in Africa, we have to guard against and making sure that everything is done properly. And after each and every bill it has been enacted, Parliament will have a sort of regulations. The regulations will be published in the Government Gazette. And every member of the public, including different companies, you will have a chance through Parliament to look into those regulations. It has been a concern, not from you only, but other companies that have come before you. And there's no way that when we are busy dealing with the bill, we should be looking at regulations, obviously. But not at this moment, we're trying to make sure that other things, I mean, this is an amendment bill, and we are trying to make sure that is going to help the country with investment, but that investment should not make the richer and the poor more poor and leave our people being the same. We have to improve people's life. I think it should be
Honorable Schmidt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure where to begin, but let's begin. the Chamber of Mines, which is very concerned to me, I haven't yet seen a submission. And it appears to be that they requested an extension, and to date I have not seen a submission. In addition to that, they've also given a half an hour meager time. let's just put that on record. And I haven't seen it, and I don't know what their views are, but that's the extent to which they regard the law as having enough reason to request for an extension. But to return to your point, can I just ask, because there seems to be GATT and an European Union Free Trade Agreement, which deals with the regulation of export. Would some of those comments also be applicable to any of the other issues, and particularly relating to having a declared a designated mineral, determining the percentage to be beneficiated? There's something else which I can't recall for the moment. But are any of those comments you've made applicable to those other ministerial discretion which are contained in law. The third point is and I don't hold any brick or any change to it, but on a legal opinion provided to us, the question was asked whether it is legally permissible for the Mineral Petroleum Resource Development Bill to amend regulatory parameters applicable to upstream petroleum projects that have been commenced, in other words, where technical cooperation permits and exploration rights have been applied for or awarded prior to the promulgation of the law. In other words, where there's already been an application for and granted, whether the retrospective applicability of these, and it was found as follows, basically, I mean, but it says that should the bill be passed by Parliament without the concerns and questions expressed by industry being addressed through meaningful feedback and engagement, it may be susceptible to judicial review. So that's on the basis. Different, but coming to the same conclusion. Your comments on that would be appreciated. Yes, for the moment, thank you.
Honourable Lorna?
Yeah, there's a lot to think about there. You talked about ways in which this bill would violate laws or treaties, which included the stability framework, the international laws and treaties on export licensing, possible violation of our own constitution, retroactivity we've heard from elsewhere. This would seem that if this bill was passed as is, it would open the door on a whole slew of legal challenges. Is that right? And what would that do to enforceability of this bill? And then I just want to focus on one area, and that is of the penalties that are envisaged. Because what we seem to be looking at is very stiff penalties in a variety of instances for breaking the law which is not clear. Is that right? Do you think, do you think that will have a chilling effect on investment?
Thank you, Jeffers. I think, yeah, there's a lot to think about. But every economic activity in South Africa is made to enhance the developmental agenda of the state. The this piece of legislation, which is MPRDA, sought to regulate actors in that economic activity, so that everyone would get a chance. I realize that even in your earlier assertion, I think last year or year, that one, you said the PRDA is unlawful. I'm not sure whether you went to an extent of saying it's unconstitutional. And I expected that an honorable member Puno is saying that the company would rewrite the bill. But one little thing that I would want to understand, especially when you look at your first in, first assessed scenario, you suggest that these rights should be auctioned. Now, what does it say in your view about government agenda of developing countries? I mean, of developing this country. And I would also like to touch on the fact that South Africa is a developing country, and it cannot be equated with developed countries. Why would you pitch it against countries like Australia and other countries that you have mentioned at this early stage, 20 years into democracy? Why would you want us to be so perfect? I'm not saying we should go astray and break the laws, treaties, and constitutions, but what is your take if you look at South Africa, its developmental agenda, and the economic activity that wants to shape? Thank you.
Well, listening to the presentation made by Mr. Leon, I think catches quite a lot of issues which can easily create an impression that we are in a crisis. And whereas I think the useful dialogue that is generated by the discussion on the bill is to facilitate, I think, the basis for commonality in addressing part of the fundamental questions that I think my colleagues indicated, that we are a country that is still progressively in transition. So there are issues that are proposed in the legislation. I think the stated issues of rights enshrined in the Constitution, but also the same Constitution provides obligations
that we have to address fundamental issues of inequality, the legacy issues that still present their ugly head in the current bureau. So the submission, well, with quite a lot of case studies or case laws, I think it is surely would be of interest to the state law advisors, but without presenting yourself to the reality of attempting to discuss the issues at hand. South Africa is not a lawless society. I do not even entertain that thing. I don't even bother when such views, wild allegations are made, as if the basis is not legislative. The basis for the existence of legislation and fundamentally the foundation of the legislation before us creates a foundation for an official society. There's no doubt about the credibility of the legislation that we have. So insinuations that create an impression as if really some of the discussions that we have at hand when we have got to strengthen our resolve or administrative capacity to govern or to do certain issues should not be misconstrued, I think. Chair, I think I was a little disturbed by the comment. American tragedy will always be a very important issue to us. When we refer to it, we should be very sensitive of what exactly was at the heart of Marigan and whether or not those conditions, because we should not make it a sweeping statement, conditions that the workers are faced with, basic conditions, health conditions, and many other issues that we have to address ourselves, so that we should not use Marigana to reinforce some ideas which are not raising, attempting to address fundamental the core issues at the heart of the process of change. I mean, that's why the country spells out a new growth path. The NDP seeks to address those issues in the long term and create the change. I really enjoyed the presentation by Eskom when it talks about security of supply, issues of cost, and whether or not certain minerals should be classified as a critical mineral strategic areas. It's an important debate in the country, and it's a matter that we need to tighten up. But I think these presentations, at times, they don't help us debate the real issues, but rather more like hearing us in terms of addressing ourselves to issues of redress. The important issue of legislation as well is redress. Conveniently, should not be forgotten by presenters. What are we redressing? What are the issues that we need to address fundamentally in terms of resolving a part of the problem that is faced, we are faced with? Thank you.
Would you like to respond?
Yes. Thanks very much, Madam Chair. I'll respond as best I can to all these good questions. The first question around the issue raised by the Honourable Member around the Freedom Charter and the need to share in the country's wealth and my reference to these international treaties. What I would say, I mean, absolutely share in the country's wealth, but really, and in fact this goes to a number of the questions that were put to me, I mean, what one really needs to do is establish an enabling environment for mining, that mining companies invest the maximum they can in this country, whether domestic or they foreign, because that investment drives growth, and that growth drives redistribution. I am putting it perhaps in simplistic terms, but that's really the key objective, or should be the key objective of any legislation, whether it's seeking redress or otherwise. The issue around the point I was trying to make around the Clause 21D and the whole issue of administrative discretion was not to say there should be no discretion, and you can't have legislation where there's no discretion. You have to have any legislation which involves regulated powers involves discretion. What we're really saying is that discretion has to be guided, it has to be limited, and it has to be based on objective criteria.
And that, at the moment, the bill doesn't have any of that. Everything is left in the vaguest possible terms, and that's why it creates all these rule of law problems. I'm not trying to scare the committee. I'm simply trying to set the committee that these are issues which should be cognizant. And that, because it's not cognizant, then you're going to have all sorts of legal problems with this legislation where it's going to be challenged. On the issue of the regulations, being able to comment on them, I mean, I take all those points, but the fact is that it's always better to put something in legislation rather than regulations, because legislation is the primary primary force on the legislative agenda. Regulations are always subordinate, and there are, as I said, and that was the Cape case involving the government, the national government, illustrates that one needs to be careful about delegating legislative powers to the executive. In answer to the second question raised by Honourable Schmidt, on the issue of the regulation of exports under the WTO agreement, the GATT agreement, and the TDCA, and the other ministerial discretions, the short answer is, as soon as the restrictions affect exports, where they impose, if the provisions in the bill, like if we try to highlight them, deal with, create export restrictions, then you're going to engage the WTO and you're going to engage the European Union. Both of them, not just one, both of them will be engaged. And that's the thing, because, I mean, essentially what the GATT agreement did is said to member states of the World Trade Organization, you can have tariffs, you can have duties, all countries have them, but you cannot, after 1995, have restrictions, quantitative restrictions on exports or imports. So a government, a sovereign government, can't say to another government, we're not going to allow you to bring television sets into South Africa, or we're not going to allow you to, South Africa cannot impose those sorts of restrictions, and it applies to all members of the World Trade Organization. That was the point I was going to make. Jonathan, what else? The oil and gas question.
Good morning, honourable members. We haven't had quite a good opinion, but dealing with it on a general principle basis, I think we'll tend to agree. I think what's in regard to the oil and gas issue is that there's no grandfathering provision. If you had an exploration right and you sought to convert that or apply for a production right based on that exploration right, so you have the preference right to do so, you enter the market with a specific set of legitimate expectations. With the free carried interest, with the other revisions to the oil and gas provisions, you now have a whole different set of expectations. So there is an issue from an international perspective, from an international law perspective, particularly with the bilateral investment treaties, because they protect you against unfair and inequitable treatment. And changing the playing field goes directly to those provisions.
Okay. Then I was asked what the consequence would be of these breaches of both the Stability Framework Agreement and the international treaties. I mean, the short answer is the framework, the Stability Agreement between Government, Labour and Business, is understand it, the MIGDIC, which is the Mine Industry Growth Development Employment Task Team, will deal with issues which have come up under that agreement. The Deputy President is chairing a meeting of the Business, Labour and Government Forum, I think on a quarterly basis. So if there are issues under that, people would be able to claim, take those issues up there. On the international law side, clearly there are consequences because under the WTO agreement, one could land up with a complaint from another member state and would have to go to the suit 7 body. Under the EU agreement, would have to go to the Cooperation Council of the EU in South Africa. But then, under the bilateral investment treaty, and that is the risk, these are very unusual animals because they give investors the right to sue the sovereign government directly, which is very unusual. And so under those agreements, investors or mining companies would have redress under international arbitration if there was a breach of any of those treaties. As I say, there are some 23 in existence. I mean, I think that on the international, on the WTO side and the EU side, hopefully those issues will be addressed by discussions between South Africa and the members concerned. On the issue of the penalties, I mean,
that is an issue. What is the effect going to be on investment when the law is not clear? Well, there might be two issues there. The one is, I think the committee would have to look very carefully at those penalty provisions to make sure that they meet the rule of law test, that they are clear. And if they're not clear, then the court's at the end of the day, you have redress in court for those. In terms of effective investment, it's certainly not encouraging to investment to base the prospects of 10% final turnover or exports. On the next question, on the economic activity should enhance the state's developmental agenda, and that the MPRDA sought to regulate the mining industry, I completely understand that. But what I'm really saying is that what this legislation should be doing is encouraging investment, because that investment in turn creates jobs. Without investment, you don't have growth, you don't have jobs. But on the issue of the FIFA principle, I didn't say you should or you shouldn't auction rights. What I did say is that there's some merit to doing so, because it can create a capital windfall for the state, and also the oil and gas industry exploration blocks are auctioned. That's how it works. And so some mining countries, and there are only three that I know of, and they're not developed countries, Mongolia, Kazakhstan, and Liberia, have introduced an auction system for mineral rights. And actually, Liberia has quite a developed one, and they auction all their rights. They think it's working well for them, and obviously maybe the committee should talk to the Liberian government about that. But, I mean, those are three developing countries that follow that system. What I'm saying under the bill is it's not clear whether an auction system is being introduced or what is happening to the FIFA principle. It seems to me the FIFA principle has been jettisoned, that there's no real auction system coming in its place. That's all the point that I was trying to make. On the point that Africa is in transition, yes, it may well still be, and that the Constitution creates rights, it also imposes obligations. I completely accept that. But what I was really trying to say in terms of the comments around Marikana was that one needs to look at the impact of developments and, in fact, legislation on economic growth. And what one wants to do with any mining code is to encourage investment in the mining industry, not deter it. Because mining, at the end of the day, is a high-risk, high-cost, capital-intensive business. And capital, I'm afraid, is pretty uncaring about where it makes its investments. I mean, in other words, capital go for the best return it can get. And one wants to obviously encourage capital investment in South Africa.
We long over our time, but I wonder, has the auctioning system been started in South Africa? It's not been applied. Is it even law already? Not yet. I found it quite interesting that you stressed on that. I think at some stage we did hear something about this auctioning in a year or two back when we were in the committee. And our concern around that was that it was actually going to involve a particular level of people, and it was going to be exclusive to the greater masses who are interested in the mining industry. But it wasn't a viable system to make them participate financially. And I think at some stage there was even a suggestion that it should start a minimum of about 500,000, if I'm not mistaken. But I don't think it really kicked off.
I can partly answer that, Madam Chair. It is, the auction system is actually proposed in the ANC research report, the SIBS report. It was proposed by Dr. Pochadon.
Yeah, but I think the processes of development of the SIBS report, it didn't really hold water for the ANC. Andrew Schmidt?
Yes, two issues. Auctioning, of course, creates, a negative effect on the, if the intention is the redistribution of wealth. Auctioning process, of course, is the other way around. I mean, it provides the individual, the company with the most funds to be able to outbid its competitors. So, and then hence, if that's not the intention of the bill, then, and it's not first in, first to set, then what is the intention? So it creates then a merge concern, it creates a policy concern, which anything can be read in between those two lines. But the second issue I'd like to ask is the one particular submission picked up on the concentration of rights. And I think you referred to it about the abuse of the concentration of rights. It's not, it shouldn't be the concentration of rights per se, it should be the abuse. And so much so that the Competition Commission should be there to determine whether, I suppose, in the retail market, whether an acquisition or merger is anti-competitive behavior, or whether, you know, but I find that the issue shouldn't be the concentration, should be the abuse of the concentration of the rights as determined by the Competition Commission, if it could be made applicable. Whether it's applicable, I don't know, and to the mining sector, I really don't know. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to close this one now. There's a lot more to discuss. I think the last time also we also had issues that we would have loved to engage with Eva Venza, but there's just never enough time. Time is my enemy.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you,
thank you for the opportunity.
While it seems that she's not yet ready, I'm going to prepare to continue. If you would just indicate to me if Free Market Foundation is here. Do you think you can present for us immediately? Please do so. Let's give them a lecture for 5 minutes while they set up. Can you please settle down and continue? We are now going to have a presentation from the Free Market Foundation. Can we start?
Madam Chair, my name is Temba Malichungu. I am a director of the Free Market Foundation, and with me is my colleague, co-director Leon Low. We have a... let me thank you for affording us this opportunity to give oral evidence that is based on our written submission, a copy of which has been made available. The written submission itself, you will see at the end, is appended the name Eustace Davy. Eustace Davy, the co-director of the Free Market Foundation, and he is the principal author of this document. However, the document itself reflects the collective input of all four directors of the Free Market Foundation. Leon is going to be the main presenter, and the way he's going to go about in terms of his presentation is that he's going to talk to some points that he will have extracted from the document itself and others that are compatible with the message reflected in the document in our comment. And you also dwell on the broad picture in terms of commenting on the bill itself. Just one or two things about the Free Market Foundation, in order to demystify it so everyone gets to know what sort of animal this is. We, from what is implied in our name, we advocate a free market oriented economic system. So our comments are from that perspective. We are non-partisan politically, and so for us, you know, political affiliations of any members of the Free Market Foundation are totally irrelevant and significant. And we always suggest to people that they leave their political baggage by the door where they come into the Free Market Foundation and participate in discussions and other work that relates to our brief. Let me just state that before I hand over the reins to Leon Low, as I mentioned, he's going to be the main presenter. When I studied, and we studied, and we tended to concur on this, when we studied the bill, we found that it provides for many, many, many regulations. And this has been an aspect that's of great concern to us, bearing in mind that regulations, by and large, have cost implications. So this is a very important point that we'd like to impress on the committee. And on that note, I hand over to Leo.
Thank you, and Madam Chair. It is indeed an honor, and if I might say, also somewhat intimidating. I'm going to address our submission or summarize it to speak to it in two distinctive sections. I'm going to speak separately about the legal and the rule of law implications, and when I do that, it needs to be clear that in that context one is not making a policy statement. In other words, when you're dealing with the legality and the constitutionality, that is not a discussion about what mineral policy should be. It's about the legitimate and illegitimate ways of adopting that policy. Then in the second part, I will speak about the specifics, the substance of the bill and the policy, or what we would perhaps call the economics of it. In that, that is the part, let's say, where there tends to be a lot of political overtones, and we will try to deal with those and discuss the extent to which the laws of economics are politically agnostic. The laws of economics, like laws of gravity, apply regardless of political considerations. If you are running an airline, you can't go and say, well, because of our history or because of our social objectives or because of our religious beliefs, we are going to assume that gravity applies differently to different airplanes. The laws of economics are like the laws of gravity. They apply regardless of one's personal preferences. And they don't distinguish between Muslims and Christians and Jews and atheists. They are universal and uniform. So that's how we see economics. When we discuss economics, we certainly would like everybody to do their best to see it as such, as an objective set of criteria and considerations to feed into whatever the political agendas and objectives might be, which we don't particularly have. So we're saying if you, for example, want to create jobs, the laws of economics can tell you how to do that. If, on the other hand, you say we want to destroy jobs, well, the laws of economics can tell you that as well. The laws of economics don't say to you you should create or destroy jobs. It simply tells you how to do so, and that's really what we will be addressing. So when I start with the legal aspects, let me just say that the basic objectives, we think, are that we assume we all have the same objective. We want to do what's best for our country and our people, and some discussion occurred in the previous talk, which was also a Leon. He's Peter Leon. I'm Leon Lowe, so he's elevated my name to his surname, but that is the only part of it we have in common. And the discussion there about the sharing of ownership and wealth and development, I think we all agree on that, and maybe there can be some shades of difference. I do want to, however, say that I think the lady in front of me referred to the Freedom Charter. It happens to be something which two of us as former people in the struggle were clustered to and conversant with, and the founding fathers of the Freedom Charter at the time, people like Govan Mbeki, Albert Luthuli, Walter Sisulu, Nelson Mandela, all made it very, very clear that the Freedom Charter, as in Mandela's words, and I can give anyone the source on the quote if they want it, was a formula for people as a whole, meant, as he said, people in their own right. So ownership was private people owning, and he said it was a formula for the emergence of a black bourgeoisie, which was a politically correct term in those days, in a flourishing private enterprise economy. Now, it fascinates me that when Temba and I were Marxist-Leninist revolutionaries, we regarded the Freedom Charter as a capitalist sellout, as a liberal sellout. And people like Albert Luthuli said so himself. He said he edited Govan Mbeki. They were communists, but they made very clear that was not what the Freedom Charter prescribed, and it was, in fact, that there should be flourishing private enterprise economy. So I just want to get that out of the way, lest anyone thinks that we are somehow, what we will be saying is in conflict with it. Quite the contrary. I've written at length on the subject, and it is, in my view, a perfectly legitimate document. It's not, of course, national policy. It's a document of one of the parties. But I have teased the DA by asking why they don't adopt it, because if one understands its real meaning, they should be as comfortable as Coke or anyone else with it. Now, the thing about mining policy and law is we need to understand the most elementary principle of economics. This is absolutely fundamental. If you make something costly, risky, and uncertain, and if you make it less attractive, you get less of it. So if you want more minerals and more mining and more to beneficiate, there will be nothing to beneficiate unless you make getting the minerals out of the ground efficient and attractive and appealing to the people who do so. You can't beneficiate minerals in the ground. You can only beneficiate once they're out of the ground. So the first thing to do before you even talk about beneficiation is talk about a policy that is likely to mine the minerals. And that policy is one that makes it less costly, less risky, less uncertain, and more attractive. So those should be fundamental. That should be the basis of all mining and mineral policy. And once you've got that policy in place, you then have the minerals above which to debate. Do you beneficiate, or do you export and get the revenue, or how do you distribute the revenues from it, the taxes, and so on. Now, the thing about the rule of law, and Peter Leon before me did touch on this, and I'm going to be a bit stronger about it and say some things that are very fundamental. The rule of law is a word. Everyone says they follow the rule of law. You talk to anyone, are you for the rule of law? Yes, I'm for the rule of law. Every government everywhere in the world says they're for the rule of law. The rule of law is a sort of cliche. It's like saying I'm for justice, I'm for fairness. Nobody says I'm against justice. Nobody says I'm against the rule of law. But it's just a phrase. The question is, what does it mean in practice? Can you take the Cape Town City Council street trading bylaws and go through them and say, do these comply with the rule of law? Now, sad to say, many professors of law would not be able to do that. So I want to make it very, very simple and straightforward. And again, I've written extensively on this. I've delivered papers at prestigious international conferences. And I'm very, very happy to share those with anyone here who wants to read more thoroughly. I see a head nodding. With pleasure, I will share that with you. And I really do believe people in this committee, if I may say, dealing with one of the most important issues in this country, and to the extent you deal with the resource for energy, it is the most important issue in this country. Unless there is enough electricity, and unless that electricity is secure, then all of the documents we've heard about this morning, the new growth path, the national development plan, are in fact meaningless. You cannot have growth, jobs, and prosperity without much more electricity, much more secure, quick. That's a precondition. Without that, there will be no growth and prosperity. So this committee, therefore, is dealing perhaps with the most important issue in this country. So, and if I may say, if it's my intention to intimidate you. If you get it wrong, you are to blame. This committee is in charge in a very fundamental and serious way of this country. And we are here to talk very, very straight and plain with you about what you should do for this country. And it's not rocket science. It's not complicated. And we hope that we can persuade you of that as we proceed. So the rule of law says, firstly, that it comes from the old cliche, the rule of law, not the rule of man. Now, of course, that's no longer politically correct, so we would now say not the rule of person or people. In other words, to put very simply, people's rights and obligations must flow from the law, not from discretion, not from people. So rights and obligations should be a function of law, not a function of discretionary, whimsical choices. A practical consequence of not having the rule of law is real or suspected abuse and corruption. If you have discretion, as opposed to objective principles in law, then it is extremely tempting to either accuse people of corruption where there isn't any, or for people to in fact be corrupt, or abusive, or nepotistic, or whatever it might be. So if you want a clean administration, one of the things is to have the rule of law, which means less discretion and more objective criteria. And that is two elements. One is the purpose of the discretion must be clear. Now, the only branch of government in which discretion under the rule of law is considered appropriate is a judiciary. In the nature of a judiciary, it has to decide whether your evidence is right or your evidence is right. That is discretionary. And it has to decide whether you are guilty. That's discretionary. Because of that, there are very, very elaborate principles that govern how the courts work. open to the public, transparency, access to all the information, cross-examination, the right to face a refuser, presumptions of innocence, etc. So where is discretion under the rule of law? It comes with very, very elaborate checks and balances to prevent it being abused. And one of them is, for example, a right of appeal to a further independent tribunal. So in the absence of a right of appeal, you could say there is no real rule of law. The rule of law in our constitution, very few people appreciate how important it is. Section 1 of our constitution says South Africa is founded on the supremacy of the constitution and the rule of law. Now listen to that. This isn't in the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights can be varied and amended according to criteria in it. Section 1 is absolute. It's not subject to exemptions or dilution as the Bill of Rights is. And the rule of law is equal to the Constitution. It's not in it or subject to it or under it. It's got the same status. And one of the things that is important is for South Africans to grasp that and to say, what is that telling us? And how do we honour that? This is the highest possible legal status is the first section of the Constitution. Now, one of the things is that where you do have discretion, there should be clear objectives. Why is discretion granted? In other words, the minister, for example, of this bill may declare something to be a strategic minimum. Why? To what end? What's the goal of that power, of that discretion? Unless the bill says the minister must exercise this in order to achieve so-and-so, then that is just a meaningless discretion. It's a whimsical spin a coin. The minister, the executive, whatever, is not then by you, the lawmaker, given marching orders. You here make the law and the policy. And if you simply delegate or divest yourself of the lawmaking power and give it to someone in the executive must implement your law. You should not divest yourself of the function of making the law and let the executive effectively take over that function. You need to keep parliamentary oversight, legislative oversight. You are the legislator. You are the lawmaker. And this is where either if you want to delegate power, be very clear about the purpose for doing so. And then the second part is you must have the criteria that must be used when that power is exercised. In other words, you had this, for example, in the immigration case, where the Constitutional Court said, why does the minister have the power to grant immigration rights? And by what are the considerations the minister should have power? That's what the Constitutional Court says. You've got to give two things. One is, why are you giving the power, you giving the power to someone in the executive? And secondly, when they exercise that power, a sort of checklist of the considerations that must go into that exercise. Then the other one is the separation of powers. Everyone again talks about it. If you say to people in democracies, they will all say, we believe in the separation of powers. Like we believe in justice, we believe in motherhood. But what does that actually mean? And what it means is really very, very simple. You make the laws here. The executive implements the law. They're not just another law-making body. They're just not a sort of another parliament. This is the parliament. And then the judiciary must adjudicate. Now what you are subjected to are what all legislators in the world are subjected to. This is not South Africa specific. Every legislation in the world, legislature, has under it an executive which will constantly ask the legislature to give it more and more power. Bigger budgets, more power. All of the proposals that will come to the executive, to you, are going to be asking you essentially to divest yourself of your job. They're going to be asking you to turn them into the lawmaking branch of government. You, the lawmakers in every country, have a profound responsibility, which is to be the brakes on that, is to be constantly vigilant and constantly saying no when they go when they want to take over, when they want you to let them take over your job of being the ultimate lawmaker. Now, in our submission, we have highlighted the provisions in the bill that, in our view, seem very, very clearly and to quite a substantial and radical degree to be in conflict with the rule of law. In other words, it gives discretionary power without objectives and without criteria. So we would say, you as the lawmaker, to put it bluntly, should say to the executive, go away, redraft the bill and give it to us. If you want us to give you these powers, you've got to tell us by what criteria you plan to exercise these powers. In other words, you here must actually not let them do what executives everywhere in the world do. And the legislators have a very profound responsibility. There are other provisions in the rule of law, like due process, where you have regional managers and ministers making decisions. You need to also spell out under section 195 of our constitution what the procedure must be. You can't just make decisions, or even words like insult, that doesn't really mean anything. There must be meaningful, proper public participation, especially of the kind that is going to be important for the thing that's been mentioned here, people like Morihara. Tembe, you see, is giving me marching orders here. This is when he doesn't think I'm performing to his satisfaction. I get these little notes, and he keeps me under wraps here. Let me move on then, and I'm going to get to Tembe's point.
Sorry, yeah. Just mind your head.
Yes, okay. I'm going to move quickly now. That's what I want to say about the law. And I really sum up, you must be quite clear that you are not delegating the lawmaking function to the executive, and if you do so with very clear marching orders. Now, let's deal with some of the economics. Beneficiation, which is one of the principal purposes of this bill, Lesedja Kanyago, the former DD of Finance and now Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank, I was at a business dinner where he was speaking, and business people said to him, you, the government, need to give us more incentives to beneficiate. His words to them were, I'm quoting him, beneficiation is nonsense. Now, that's strong language. Let me explain what his argument was. And his argument was, and you will face this, you are faced with people who are going to come to you and tell you why you should do this, because they want, as industry, big vested interests, capitalist interests in this country, are going to say, yes, this is a good idea, because what they have in mind is there will be government subsidies, there will be subsidies by the mining industry, cheap minerals, the country will lose the money it can make from the minerals by selling them at a discount and a subsidy to the industrialists who will encourage you to do this. And Lesedja Kanyago said that saying we must beneficiate what we produce is saying like a farmer must beneficiate the produce and cook the meals rather than sell it to a restaurant that cooks the meals. You don't say to the farmer, beneficiate your produce. On the contrary, you say to the farmer, sell it to someone who beneficiates it best, which is a restaurant, or the people catering for backyard. So beware of this beneficiation. It's one of these what are called weasel words. It's become a sexy word, everyone uses it, but how many people actually think it through? Do we really make ourselves better off by producing something we're bad at producing? Or by selling it to somebody who's good at producing and importing, for example, if we don't produce pearls, but we're good at producing pearl jewelry, we import it. As Lesedja pointed out, all commodities have a universal world price. They're the same for everyone. And there's no reason why the place where it's produced should be better at beneficiating than somewhere else. And what you need is an economy that is efficient and that we produce things competitively regardless of where the resources come from. That's really what this country needs to prosper. It was mentioned in the earlier talk that there might be a regulatory impact assessment for this bill. I just want to not let you forget that. It has been policy of this government now for nearly a decade that regulatory impact assessment should be introduced. It's Special departments, divisions were created in the presidency. The Department of Finance, I myself was used as a consultant by the Department of Trade and Industry, but so far it hadn't happened. Now, I'm sorry to say that my friend and one who I respect, want to say Peter Leon, said that you should conduct it. There's an important thing here. Regulatory impact assessments must quantify everything. Rule one. This is international standards. Secondly, they must be done by the neutral agency, never by the department that proposes the measure. And you could commission one, that's true, but it's best for, you should, but it's best for the country to have an autonomous agency that takes responsibility for giving you, the legislators, a regulatory impact assessment before you consider such a measure. Because if you consider this measure without one, you have no way of knowing whether the country will be better off or not. You can have these discussions, you can listen to my opinions or your own opinions, but in the absence of a properly conducted cost-benefit analysis, nobody knows whether this is going to have net benefits or costs for the country. And so I want to just endorse that and encourage it. Then, perhaps one of the other issues here is, this bill reflects a deep misunderstanding and mistrust of the role of markets and entrepreneurship. And this is very problematic because something that is not debatable, countries with freer economies perform better. Now, if anyone doubts that, it's really readily available information on the internet. This is perfectly thoroughly studied. It's documented. It is not subject to informed debate. Freer economies outperform less free economies. And I can happily again provide the information. For now, you just have to accept that as a fact. Now, this proposes much, much more regulation. In other words, by the world's experience, including our BRICS partners and our neighbours, Botswana, other African countries like Ghana, which have moved toward, and Mozambique, towards market economies, towards more certainty in mining mineral rights, less discretion, more trusting of markets and prices. These are the countries that are now achieving the world's highest economic growth rates. Sub-Saharan Africa, which used to be called DAC Africa, is now the highest growth region in the world. During the so-called financial crisis, Africa's growth rates rose. They didn't even slow down. And we in South Africa went the other way. We stagnated. The difference between us and them is they are liberalizing their economies and we are intensifying our regulation, as with this bill. This bill takes us in the direction that is the opposite of our BRICS partners, the opposite of, of our region, and our growth is stagnating and theirs is booming. Now, if we want to be prosperous, it's not rocket science, it's simple. You actually have to liberalize. If you don't, you will stagnate, and that's what the world's experience tells you. Madam Chair, I want to leave some time for questions. I would like to make comments on questions like auctions. Let me just make one small comment on that. I'm not saying I'm particularly for or against auctioning mineral rights, but I was fascinated by the idea that the government getting more money is not developmental. This is what I understood the discussion to be about. It was proposed that if you auction, which is what developing countries are increasingly doing, you maximize the revenue the country gets from its mineral rights. Now that money in the hands of the government, it seemed to me the implication was it's not developmental. Surely that is developmental. It's not clear that getting mines to dish out arbitrary benefits to local communities in other countries. Mines pay wages and salaries. They don't get involved in housing and transport and schools and development. They pay tax and royalties to the government, which is then responsible for that. We have here the legacy of apartheid, which is the patronizing idea that migratory labor goes to the mines and then is looked after by the mines. If we want to be an emancipated, liberated country, we need to get to the point where the labor is not migratory, where it lives in its own houses, and, if I might add, as freehold, freely tradable land title, not living as tenants of either the government or the mines, but as owners of the houses and their land. So there's much to say. Timber is agitating. I think it's because he wants to add something, or he thinks I'm busy saying something wrong, but he's interfering with me, Madam Chair. I need you to protect me. Yeah, over to you, Timber.
I think this is right because he worries about the fact that you've already taken 20 minutes.
I wanted us to remain or to be in the good books of
this
committee, not to hear the wrath of the members. You know, we would like them to be still focused on our input. Thank you.
Thank you for that interesting approach. Do honourable members want to engage, or is the message clear? Honourable Santor, then honourable Mahai.
Chairperson, the layout was clear. I think the presenter gave us a structure of how things are being done and how to follow legal trends. But I just want to pick up on your understanding, on your last point. When we talk about South Africa being a developmental state, we do not say that government should be poor. A poor government cannot perform. That is given. But what we're saying, auctioning these rights at this stage would only benefit those that have money. You are actually saying that we need to keep the status quo. The top five companies should be the one who buy these mining rights. But that's the caution that we are advancing. That if you do that at this stage, then you would not have your first time entrance into the industry. And that is what we want to introduce. I'm quite interested in hearing how nonsensical beneficiation is. I'm interested in that debate, but definitely because of time it's not up here. If it's not for job creation, I don't know what it is for. If it is not for the benefit of more people in the industry, then I don't know what it is. I wish I could meet the person who said it's nonsensical to beneficiaries, so that I can hear his analysis of this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chair, and thanks, Peter, for presentation, and I think there's a caution that we should not abdicate our responsibilities as members of parliament. Our basic task is to make laws, and the theory of separation of powers, we agree with it. But however, I just want to learn, honestly, I just want to learn, is there a major contrast that can be drawn between the South African minerals legislation and that of Mozambique and Ghana? Which are those areas, if they could be highlighted? Secondly, on your theory of stagnation, do you believe that there's vanishing investment opportunities in South Africa? It seems to be saying that the economy is stagnated. And if the economy has stagnated, there is no investment on very critical areas, which are pillars of growth and development of the economy. Would you be kind to highlight those areas? And lastly, Chair, I read the economy, the Reserve Bank interviewed with regard to the call for sacrifices, mainly three areas that they are making, to say business, labor, and government must negotiate a consensus
on which areas should constitute sacrifices for economic growth and development. But I agree with the comment made on beneficiation. The issue of beneficiation arises out of IPAP 1 and IPAP 2, new repairs. We have clear job drivers, areas that constitute pillars of job drivers. So it is not a thumbsack. It's not because of the whims. Somebody, when the climate is fine, saying beneficiation. When the weather is not fine, we say no longer beneficiation. The basis for it is that the economy has to re-industrialize for us to realize the growth, tackle poverty. We do not, politics is an expression of economics. We do not exist for all sake. There's a balance in which we have to address ourselves to, in the interest of certain. I like it because it's fair to you are a resigned Marxist-Leninist. But however, we shape by what prevails in the direction that you have today.
Thank you. Thank you,
Chair. I just seek clarity on migrant labourers. Yeah, as you are saying it, I feel it, but I don't see how possible can it work. Because we have thousands and thousands of these laborers in mind. And now if you say, if I understand you when you say it's an apartheid way of doing, you know better than I do, and where are we going to get these that stay near the mine, those that don't need housing?
Mine is but one sentence. We have to get the mineral beneath the soil. Getting that mineral beneath the soil is a laborer, most probably of black descent, who has to get it. It can be these days another of somebody, it can be a father of somebody. But that laborer needs to be treated with dignity, respect, and a fair share of what he's digging for. I think that's where our critical area of concern is, when it comes to getting that mineral beneath the soil. And that's where our qualms are presently. Those inequalities that have been created are what is getting us all roundabout and trying to get an answer. But law has to apply. Would you care to respond to some of those issues?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me respond to some aspects of questions that have been raised, and Leon will deal with whatever I do not deal with. Now, very serious trouble in the country, really serious trouble. One of the facts that we need to really try to come to terms with and try for that to inform us in terms of what we ought to be doing is the fact that between 2011 and 2012, we lost 24% of foreign direct investment overall. Who did we lose it to? And this is very important. We lost that 24% primarily to neighboring countries in sub-Saharan Africa. That's Mozambique and many of the sub-Saharan countries. That's who we have been losing it to. So that means that should send us a very, very urgent signal that we need to look very, very critically and carefully and urgently at the policies that we have in existence and those that we are currently proposing. So, in response, direct response now to some aspect of question that was raised with the first question that was raised by the Honourable Member of Parliament. The Member of Parliament alluded to the status quo, mentioning that there are five companies that rule the roost in the mining industry. Now, the appropriate policy response to that ought to be that unnecessary legislative and regulatory barriers to entry should be removed. When that happens, and this here is the responsibility of the committee, amongst others, other committees, when you have all these unnecessary barriers to entry removed, and the cost of going into business is lowered, you are going to have a situation where the industry is going to be attractive to potential investors domestically and also foreign investors. That's the bottom line. That's the bottom line. That's the one thing that needs to be focused on. And so we look at existing policy, we look at policy proposals, and through those binoculars, and actually ask ourselves, will they enhance, you know, the challenge of rendering the industry, you know, the country seductive to investment. This is a challenge that's being faced by this committee. And so having said that, I think, when you have removed the unnecessary barriers to entry, you will have a proliferation of businesses. This occurs in any other industry. Now, with being particularly conscious of the fact that in the mining industry, it is very capital intensive, very high capital, very high risk. So this actually requires special measures in terms of removing the unnecessary barriers to entry and making sure that the industry is incentivized. That's the thing to do. And not to come up with, you know, policy proposals that might have the effect, but not the intention of being punitive. You want the policy proposals to translate into an incentivized environment. So you can have all the money industrialists all over the world and just see South Africa as the ultimate destination for investing in the mining industry. Leon, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
One more minute, so that we can move on.
Yeah, I'll be as briefly as I can. Firstly, the question about beneficiation from the first honourable member. I don't want to speak for Lesedje Lakanyago, who's a very competent and brilliant person, and I would, if the Reserve Bank would release him, I would encourage you to invite him here to come and have a session with you. It might be difficult for that to happen in public. I don't know how these things work. But his point is this, that you do not do yourself a favor in an economy if you do what you do inefficiently. If you have compulsory beneficiation, what it amounts to is you force the mines to produce less because it's now less productive, profitable for them, and you force them to subsidize industries which are inherently internationally uncompetitive because they can't compete at world prices for inputs. So his argument would be what you rather want in the economy is companies that are competitive and efficient and can compete on world markets and do not need subsidies from the mining industry. If you want to beneficiate at all, then you have to maximize the mining output. Our mining output fell when the rest of the world rose. Our BRICS partners in particular, the rest of the African countries have soaring mineral production, we have falling mineral production. His argument would be you want to make mineral mining and for the interests of the workers, the chair's comment and question, you want to maximize the revenue with which to mine and with which to pay and reward workers and give them decent dignity and working conditions. And that you do not do by forcing the mines to subsidize inefficient, uncompetitive industries. I think that would be his argument, and I hope I'm not doing an injustice. Then the honorable member, this is the second one, the contrast between South Africa and Ghana and Mozambique were the two countries mentioned and others. The contrast is that they have all moved, like has Botswana, like have our BRICS partners, towards increasing the certainty and the long-term nature, the ability to make long-term investments without any ability for those to be disrupted. In other words, to make it a high capital, long-term investment appealing to the investor. As it happens, my daughter is living in Ghana and is an engineer on one of those mines, and she is describes to me how the government of Ghana is doing everything it can to encourage the mining company to invest and stay there, and certainly moving away from what we are moving towards. This is the significant difference. On the question of stagnation, the economy of South Africa, we went for the first decade after 94, our score on the International Economic Freedom Index rose, and our growth rates rose after 30 years of stagnation in South Africa. Full generation of stagnation, we started growing at perfectly respectable international growth rates. Then in about 2006, 2007, for some reason, we stopped moving up the index. We flattened off and are now moving down the index. Our growth rate has, as predicted by the index, therefore fallen. Then the third honourable member's question about the migratory labour. I am going to say as much as I think I can without divulging any confidences, but I want to refer specifically to Marikana. London Mine had to pay under the mining charter into a trust which was under the administration, I think this is public knowledge, of the, I think, the provincial government. They paid in something like R500 million, none of which had been spent or invested in developing the community. We, the Free Market Foundation, proposed that what we would do is go to the community, we would consult the community, and one of the things we would do for the community is give them full freehold title over the land they occupy. I don't think any of you would be surprised to know that our view is, had that happened, we would not have seen Marikana. Had the people been owners of their homes, as opposed to older apartheid-style migratory labourers living in someone else's land and under horrible living conditions. We want to get people to be respected, we want them to be treated decently, we want them to be treated permanently, not as migratory labourers. We really have to get that legacy out of our minds. Apartheid lives on in our heads, and we need to actually stop seeing these communities as somehow somehow has to be looked after by either the government or the mining company, but as emancipated, well-paid people as in any other country who look after themselves and own their land and their houses. I mean, that's the sort of thing we would have. And then, yes, Madam Chair, you're absolutely right, the dignity of workers, and one of the ways to maximize the potential for that is to make sure the mining industry is growing and viable and vibrant. Our concern with this bill is it might actually have the opposite effect.
Thank you very much. Time is at stake. And noted. Can we then immediately get CNR? Just see about it. Thank you.
Okay, kids, that's
the biggest influence on that's the thing we often I don't know if it's
okay, good afternoon, Madam Chairman and honorable members of Parliament. My name is Steve O'Riordan, and I'm General Manager for Canadian Natural Resources, and I'm based here in Cape Town. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to this committee today. I've been with Canadian Natural Resources now for 28 years, but I think any of you who know North America will instantly recognize I'm not from Canada, but my accent is from a lot further south. But I'm part of the club because I've been with the company now for quite some time. The last 12 years I've been in West Africa as general manager for Angola, for Nigeria, and for Gabon. And I have quite an unusual background that maybe will explain the way I put my presentation together. I'm not a geologist, engineer, accountant, lawyer, or any of those things. I'm not a technical person, but I started out in the industry as what was called then personnel manager. These days it's called human resources, of course, but I started in that way. I got my first job in general management when our general manager in Angola got malaria. I went to sit in his chair. He didn't come back, and I didn't leave. So my career has gone on from there. I've come to love Africa, and I think I've really drawn a long straw here by being assigned to Cape Town. So I'm going to give a presentation today that's going to be a lot different from the ones you've seen. It's going to include images about our business, which are typical of what you will see. A lot of them have come from our company in particular, but I think we can really share those images and help me, hopefully make it easier to understand what we're talking about with our business. I'd also like to demonstrate the vast sums of capital that are required to participate, to find the opportunities that are reasonable, to progress these opportunities, to make discoveries, make development projects from that, and also a hidden cost really is the maintenance of these facilities and the decommissioning of them after their economic life. After my presentation, I'd also like to support what my industry colleagues have said over the past couple of days about the potential damaging effect of this amendment bill, and I'd like to compare with them when I get to that point. So lots of pictures, not so many graphs or bullet points, and I have not copied any of this text to you, and I'll be glad to do so after this presentation is over. My company is Canadian Natural Resources. We're headquartered in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and we are the second largest oil and gas company in Canada. We produce really three different types of products that we try to keep in balance. One is natural gas. We have a huge holding of undeveloped acreage in Western Canada for natural gas. Our second product is from enhanced recovery oil in Western Canada. About a third of our assets are involved with this. And then finally, what we're here to talk about is the offshore oil and gas business. This is an interesting photo here. This is the Murchison platform, which straddles the Norwegian and the UK border. This platform now has reached the end of its economic life, and we're going to decommission it. Decommissioning means that we completely remove this facility from the sea with no environmental trace, and it takes millions and millions of pounds to plan for this and to execute with no damage to the environment. One of these hidden costs we don't talk about too much. This is something the slide really can't do justice, but this is Aberdeen, Scotland. This is called the Offshore European Oil and Gas Capital. And again, the slide will really tell the tale, but that's a pretty nice looking day there in Aberdeen. And I would like to see some hub like this, some center of excellence for our industry to be located in South Africa. It could be in Durban, it could be in Saldanha Bay, which we talk a lot about, but we need to be able to capitalize on this. The number of jobs that have been brought to Aberdeen, the new technology, the new services, the new people have made this a boom area. Aberdeen has been the oil capital of Europe now since the middle 60s. It could have been another town. It could have been Dundee, for example, but it wasn't. It's Aberdeen. It's now going through a new renaissance. Last week, the Oil and Gas Conference for the UK was held in Aberdeen. There were delegates from all over the world. It was the biggest ever. The new technology on display, the new services, the new products are mind-boggling. I'd also point out that Aberdeen now has the lowest unemployment rate in the UK. It's because of the oil and gas industry offshore. I want to see this happen in South Africa. This is the Ninian Central platform. I thought you'd be interested to see what this thing looks like. Ninian Central was the largest concrete structure made by man and ever moved. And this was installed in 1977. The Ninian field at that time produced 375,000 barrels of oil a day. 375,000. We produce in South Africa now, 375,000. It's gone down, of course, quite a bit. And he guesses today what it is? It's about 15,000 barrels a day. So how do we make money at this? We do it by maintaining our facility, anticipating what maintenance is going to be required, and above all, investing the money in it. Planning for that money, setting it aside, and investing it. These sea conditions here, you'll recognize this could look like the seas around South Africa. We have this to deal with in the North Sea. This vessel is also an interesting one. It is a floating production vessel, and this was sitting above our Banff and Kyle fields. Oil people in the back of the room will recognize this as being an old seismic vessel that's been converted into a production vessel. This was produced very happily, about 7,000 barrels a day in November of 2011, and then the dreaded 100-year storm hit northeast Scotland. It was one of the worst in decades. Lots of damage done, and of course these vessels out in the North Sea were rocked around quite a bit. The point of pointing this out is that everything, our contingency plans work for us. The vessel stayed on the station, it didn't move, but what we did was we disengaged the riser pipe from the seabed up to the vessel. We disengaged that in case there might be some more movement, we would have some oil spill. Everything worked to plan, the vessel stayed on the station, no injuries to people, no damage to the environment, but damage to our company. One day you're on 7,000 barrels a day, the next day, zero. Now, in November 2011 to today, this field is still not back on stream because of repairs we've had to make and because of further investment in, well, getting the field back rehabilitated and commissioned. So, I won't say easy come, easy go, but these are the sort of things that happen on a daily basis in our industry. Here in Africa, our company has been working offshore for 20 years, and this is our first project. This is in Angola, and our field was called Kiami. And the letters FPSO means Floating Production Storage and Offloading Vessel. This is a tanker that was built in 1975. Once it finished its life as a transport tanker, it was then converted into an FPSO. You can't see too well on this photo here, but the top sides are filled with equipment that will separate oil, gas, and water, and the vessel in the background is now about to receive an export cargo. This will then go off to the market. This vessel holds about 1 million barrels of crude oil storage, but you don't want to wait until it's filled up. You anticipate when you need to export oil from this particular vessel. The story of this one is that we based our economics on this project at around $30 a barrel to make money. The first cargo that we exported made $7 a barrel. In the mid-90s, you may recall, oil price took a little dip. So $7 a barrel is not too good. It had a knock-on effect. The oil price went up quite quickly, but took years to recover. And I think that after maybe 8 years of production with this vessel, we just about broke even. Maybe just about. Here's another interesting one, and one near and dear to my heart. This is in Gabon, and this is the logo that signified our field. Aloe is a Niani word from the coastal regions of Gabon. It means mouth of the river. Our field is located just offshore in sight of land and right near the mouth of the Agui River. The hippo there is famous. Maybe you've read about it. These are the famous surfing hippos that come out of the forest down to the sea, they have a little swim, and back into the forest. For the people of this region, hippos demonstrate strength, integrity. They are the creature that is revered. So here's our logo. We're strong. We've got the hippo. We've got the mouth of the river. Everything is going our way. And the field now looks like this. Again, apologies for the clarity of the slide. But the FPSO is based here amongst the wellhead platforms, and things have not worked out for us very well. We have overestimated the amount of oil in place, and we've had a myriad of technical and operational problems that I won't even go into at this minute. But this field now produces about 3,000 barrels a day instead of about 25,000 barrels a day, and that's what we had expected. We have already, on our corporate books, written off the cost to develop this field, and now we're just safely producing as best we can and looking for the ways that we can invest in Gabon to get this field back in its proper form and to look for other opportunities. Again, we didn't anticipate that, and my point to you is that it's not always as you anticipate it might be in our business. This is a good news story. This is in Cote d'Ivoire. We have two fields there. One is called Baobab, and one is called Espoir. This is our Baobab Ivorian FPSO. This holds 1 million barrels of crude oil storage. And again, export tankers will come to this vessel, take away cargoes, and go to the market. We've been in Cote d'Ivoire now for about, since the late 90s, and we've had great success there through some very turbulent periods. I want to show you this slide because I think it's critically important for you to understand. In Cote d'Ivoire, even with small fields, we have, for the country and for ourselves, produced over 140 million barrels of oil there. The gas, the associated gas, which we send to the coastline by pipeline, is just icing on the cake. The crude oil has made a big, big difference in Cote d'Ivoire. What also makes a big difference is our interaction with the people of Cote d'Ivoire. We are Ivorians. Our general manager is Ivorian. Our production manager is Ivorian. All of our main top jobs are with Ivorian people. This is my friend and colleague, Katia Sise. She's in our village here near the coast in Abidjan. And you will, I'm sure, very well know what Cote d'Ivoire was like in 2011. Absolute turmoil, death and violence all over the place. We supported villages like this through our own people, through cash, and through the fact that we are Ivorians. Ivorians run the business. We will do the same thing in Gabon. We'll have a Gabonese general manager there shortly, and this is our plan. We will do the same thing in South Africa. South Africa, here we are. CNR is the holder of an offshore license, block 11B-12B, which is located directly south of Muffle Bay. Our drilling target there would be maybe about 180 to 200 kilometers directly south of Muffle Bay in undrilled territory. This is just a look at the block. Again, you can't see it very well. I've got a fancy slide there in the corner to show you exactly where it is, but that is a large parcel of land. That's about 19,000 square kilometers of block. It has been drilled in the northern section for gas by Sucor a number of years ago. Ours is in virgin territory with high prospectivity. Now, what are we going to do? We feel that we have, as a company, we have made an obligation. We signed a contract with South Africa under certain terms that we will drill this exploration well within our first exploration period. This we will do next year. However, the uncertainty of the future regulatory regime of petroleum in South Africa is of great concern to us. Our economic case and our legitimate expectations have been built around our contract, around the framework, the rights, and the commitments contained in this contract. We've invested here in South Africa based on that. Changes to these terms could result in us thinking very long and hard about how we would further explore this block, how we would develop discoveries, and how we would go forward. Our written submission to this committee states our own company's position on matters related to the amendment bill. We fully support our colleagues who have spoken for us in the last couple of days. We are a signatory of the OPASA submission ourselves, and we want to see some progress made. Uncertainty is the word that we've been talking about a lot in the past couple of days, and uncertainty about whether or not it's state participation, free state carry, beneficiation, which is the applicable charter, export controls, all that uncertainty adds up to the potential for the industry to be stopped in its tracks before it even gets off the ground. It doesn't have to be this way. We want to sit down with government and engage in meaningful consultation to work these issues out. And there's a tremendous amount at stake here. Finally, all you South Africans know, South Africans know this, this is God's own country. This is a place that is a wonder. And we will never engage in any activities here that will, to our knowledge, will damage the environment or harm any of our people. We want to work in concert with this country and make a great success of it. And I think that's all I've got to say.
Thank you. You say you've started already?
We have not.
You have not started?
Our exploration right was signed.
An exploration right was signed.
That's right. Last May, we have 3 years to drill our commitment well, which we will do.
Often about being a signatory of, you said, OPASA, offshore. Who are your partners in essence? From the South African,
we are at this moment 100% holders of this block. However, we have identified a partner to join with us to share this risk and to lend their technical expertise to a very challenging well and potentially a development. We can't disclose who that partner is yet. It's still with government for approval. I expect within a very short time we'll be able to announce our partner, and we'll do this as a joint development.
Wish to engage, Mr. Honourable Lorimer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So just to get this straight, has there been any consultation with the Department on the proposed changes to the regulatory regime? Any consultation?
Consultation with the GMR?
No, just in general. On the terms under which you are operating, and with the prospect that they might change, have been consulted on those possible changes?
Please make this up your mic.
We haven't been consulted directly. We have consulted with the DMR indirectly on these matters, and we have written to Minister Shabangu about these.
We've talked to Minister Shabangu about it, not the DMR.
Minister Shabangu.
Member, can we pass? Honourable Kuno.
Thank you, Chairperson. What is the district want us to change? I mean, you are saying that it should this law be passed in your presentation? It's going to make you go away from South Africa.
No.
You are going to take your investment elsewhere. What exactly do you want us to pass here? You know, your colleagues earlier on, the representatives, the ones before them, they're saying government is over-regulating them. But things have not been right. I think you've been here for some time. You see things that are not right. And somebody has to regulate. And government has to do that. And they're saying they're over-regulating, which is exactly what you're saying. Maybe not in those terms, but that's what you're saying. But what exactly would you like us, in any section of this bill that you're talking about now, what is it that you want to see change or what you want to amend? Thanks.
Respond to that.
Okay. What our company would like, and I think what our colleagues would like, is that the contract that we have signed with the South Africa is honored, and that's it, really. We are here and investing on the basis of that contract. And if that changes, our whole investment view may change. It may not, but it may. That's what we like. We've signed. We want what we signed up for.
That's it. Thank you very much. do we have Centre for Applied Legal Studies?